This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. We welcome you again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. Hello to all. This is Milton Rosenberg.
We'll talk about that tonight on Extension 720.
Chicago, Justin Kaufman here with Extension 720 with you till 10 o'clock tonight. Here at 720 WGN, beautiful night. Storms have come through. Excited to be on the air tonight. We missed out all last week, Pete. Pete Zimmerman here, of course, as he is every night that we broadcast. All last week, because the White Sox played night games, we did not have a chance to broadcast, be a part of the WGN day schedule. We course, do our podcast, Lower Wacker Live, which you can find at WGNradio.com. Do that every day. But not being with the nighttime listeners here at 720 WGN was tough, Pete. I know it was tough. But we're back, and we put together a nice little show this evening for you. We also have a show coming up on Thursday. But right now, tonight, we theme these shows, these extension 720s, and I'm excited to say that this one's really rooted in Chicago history. Let's first start with Maxwell Street. The Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events, the city DCAS, there's this extended effort to try and put more emphasis on the markets in the city of Chicago. And that could be anything from, you know, farmers markets to other festivals, street festivals. But this upcoming weekend, they're going to be putting an emphasis on Maxwell Street. And a lot of people are like, huh? Maxwell Street? I see the signs that honor the old Maxwell Street. I go over there and look at a plaque. Maybe go to that steak, Steak and Shack. What is that place? Shake Shack. Not Shake Shack, but the Steak and Shake. Steak and Shake. The new one that's right there. But they don't think of that Maxwell Street exists. But there is the Maxwell Street Market, which has been going on in that area ever since, really, the honorary Maxwell Street went away. And they're putting some more emphasis on bringing publicity and more coordination to the market, and more music and more festival-like things, family-friendly things, to bring Maxwell Street back. So we'll talk about the music, we'll talk about the memories, we'll talk about the history, and we'll talk, of course, we got to talk about the blues, and Loreen and the Maxwell Street Market Blues Band will be in our performance studio, some live music tonight on Extension 720. How about that? I could do a three. I mean, I could do all night talking about Maxwell Street. I feel that my dad always told stories about being on the fruit and vegetable trucks. His dad was selling vegetables and fruit, and he would go down there and he would.
Is it mostly just food?
For him,
socks.
Yeah,
things like that.
I know it to be
detergent.
Yeah. I know it to be tube socks and detergent. That's how I know it from living in the city. Anytime I've been, let's go down to Maxwell Street. I go down there, I'm like, well, this is just a lot of Lysol. Wholesale, big bulk Lysol. But no, my dad used to say it was obviously fruit and vegetable was a big thing, and that's where you got your markets. But the iconic kind of, I don't know, like sitting on the crate, John Lee Hooker, Blues Brothers vibe of Maxwell Street is what I think everybody thinks about when you think of Maxwell Street.
Yeah.
So we'll talk with the musicians about that and Stewart, who's one of the musicians, actually played at the old Maxwell Street and plays at the new. So we'll talk with him about the differences. So that's coming up. Also, we continue our tour of Chicago neighborhoods. We've done so many so far, over 20, 25, trying to get to 77. Tonight, let's go to Old Town. Lots to talk about in Old Town. We go up to the Old Town Ale House, talk with raconteur Bruce Elliott. Bruce, anyone who's been in that bar knows who Bruce is. Bruce, of course, the artist who all the work in that bar is his. He had a star turn being Anthony Bourdain's friend. When Anthony Bourdain would come to Chicago, they talked to Bruce. Well, we talked to Bruce tonight about the changing face of Old Town, once a counterculture bastion. Now, not so much. Less bazaars, more bouncers with headsets. On Wells Street, you walk up and down that area. And I've had been to Second City, for a long time was, you know, a second home, third home for me. But the at one point, I think Miles took a class there not too long ago, 3-4 years ago, and we would walk up and down Well Street while he was doing it. And I'm like, oh, go check out some records. Maybe get, you know, get a hemp blanket. I'm like, oh, that's gone. No, instead it's bottomless mimosas and three-story bars that are up and down Well Street, where it used to be, like I said, the counterculture epicenter. So we'll talk with Bruce Elliott about Old Town. Interesting. And also, let's talk dinner theater. Philip Potempa, who many here will be familiar with his work as Chicago theater critic, and also he was on with Patty a lot. He's going to join us to talk about dinner theater. You no doubt have heard about Teatro Zanzani, which is the new show that is downtown, and everyone's talking about the sort of Cirque du Soleil meets the multi-course dinner. And, you know, that's a fantastic idea, and one that has been done for decades and decades, and including here in Chicago, as Chicago lays claim to some of the historic nature of dinner theater. Of course, there's always going to be, talked about, dinner theater is as old as medieval, not necessarily medieval times, off the expressway, but medieval times, lowercase. So anyway, you can actually sort of chart the roots of dinner theater back to the early days of Chicago theater, and we'll talk about that with Philip as we sort of celebrate the new and also take with a nod to the old. So that's the stories we're doing tonight: Maxwell Street, Old Town, and dinner theater. I think is a great sort of foray into Chicago history. We'll look to the past, not to the future. So we need a name for the episode.
Is dinner theater what I'm thinking it is, in that you get a dinner while the theater work is happening? It's
you
weird.
Nailed it. You nailed it. Wow, Pete, you nailed it. I thought this would be a really hard concept, and Pete figured it out in 2 seconds. He's like, you got it. Yeah, that's the idea, that you actually eat dinner while the show's going on. There might be little breaks and things, you know, but the concept being that you're being served almost like a wedding.
Like I think there was a show I went to see at City Winery, and they kind of have the same type of deal where, you know, you're eating while the performer is on stage, and it makes me uncomfortable.
You don't like it?
Like the waitress is coming over asking me about what soup I want, and this guy's like pouring his heart out on stage. I'm like, shh.
They should go with like the Red Robins, where you go to a Red Robin, at least the one that was in California that we stopped at one point, and they had all of it. They had no need for waiters. It was just a little screen on the table.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
hamburger, that's what they fries. Yeah. You got to do that, and then a little robot comes out from under the and puts the food on your table, and they do not get in the way of the performance. I think you're onto something. You're a hybrid.
Not chewing too loudly. Do they hear it on stage?
Yeah, and when the song's over, you've got your utensils, you can bang them on the table, you can do all sorts of things. Did you get the prime rib? I feel like prime rib would be the only way to do dinner theater. Right? That's what you, in my mind, I feel like it'd be my
a grandpa. Rice pilaf.
Ooh, rice pilaf. Can't go wrong with a rice pilaf. All right, all that show coming up tonight on Extension 720. We'll take a quick break, we'll come back, and we're going to get Loreen and the Maxwell Street Market Blues Band to perform coming up here, and we'll talk with them later in the show as well. So lots to do here tonight on Extension 720, so stay with us.
Back to Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
847 says, I'm 62 years old. I grew up in Park Ridge. My parents would take any out-of-towners to Maxwell Street on Sundays. My mother was always mortified that my dad did that. That's great. That is one of the things that I feel, you know, because then to be honest with you, I moved to Chicago in the mid-90s, 1994 or so. I grew up in the Wonder Lake area. It's not like I couldn't have come down to Maxwell Street. And I think they didn't actually close it out until the end of the 90s. So, but we're talking about Maxwell Street tonight on Extension 720. I'm Justin Kaufman. You're on 720 WGN, 312-981-7200. If you got any memories of Maxwell Street, before and after, the market continues and it thrives. And right now, the Department of Cultural Events and Special Events, they are attempting to give more credibility. I don't want to say credit. That's not right, because the market is a fantastic place, and I've been there. But they are putting more an effort into highlighting and publicizing some of the markets in town. And Maxwell Street Market is getting that favor. This weekend, on Sunday, there's going to be a huge party at Maxwell Street, and they're trying to get people to come out for not just the vendors, but for live music and food and everything in between. And they get a chance. You can go out in the morning. You check out Loreen and the Maxwell Street Market Blues Band. They're in studio, in our performance studio. We're going to talk a little bit later with them and also talk more about Maxwell Street later in the show. But right now, let's get some live music. Take it away.
All right, since we're talking about the Maxwell Street Market, I'm going to do a little Chicago blues, a little Jimmy Reed. Tell me what you want. Tell me what you want. to do. Oh, come on, baby, I'll do anything. Oh, baby, baby. Oh, but I won't do that.
Lorene and the Maxwell Street Market Blues Band, they're going to be playing down at Maxwell Street on Sunday. It's a big festival that's being put on by the Department of Cultural Affairs. Much more with them. We're going to have more music tonight and a conversation with them as well coming up here on Extension 720. So stay with us. Also, just wanted a quick programming note. Wanted to say congratulations and welcome to Ji Suk Yi, who will be joining us. She is the new co-host, contributor? To Steve Cochran Show in the Morning. G, of course, from Windy City Live, and we've known her. Pete and I both know her, and she came on the show when we were doing the show with Steve, so it's great to have her as part of the WGN family. It's going to be exciting. I'm excited for her, and congratulations. It is Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Chicago, the big city on the lake, the city that works, the hog butcher to the world, and a city of neighborhoods. 77 neighborhoods we intend to talk about, like tonight. Let's go to Old Town. Old Town is right in the heart of the north side of Chicago, a stone's throw from River North and Lincoln Park. North Avenue is the main thoroughfare, North and Wells, North and Clark, all the way down to Division. It's home to Second City, Zanies, and the Latin School. It's also home to Cabrini Green, or what's left of it. The public housing project was a mainstay in Old Town. The high rises were torn down a few years back, but some of the low row houses still are lived in. Politically, Old Town is the second ward, a hodgepodge, gerrymandered ward run by Alderman Brian Hopkins. The second includes parts of Bucktown, Lincoln Park, and downtown Chicago, Michigan Avenue. What? It also includes the mega project, Lincoln Yards. But for all the talk of mega projects and development, we can't forget about the counterculture past of this neighborhood. This was the epicenter of hippie culture in the 50s and 60s. Our little Haight-Ashbury. You could tell by the bars and bazaars that used to line Wells Street. I say used to because they're all but gone. Except for one place, the Old Town Ale House. That's where I met Bruce Elliott to talk all things Old Town. How do I describe Bruce? Not quite the owner, but not the owner. He's the face of the Old Town Ale House, thanks to his presence and his paintings all over the wall. Yes, this is the bar with the naked Sarah Palin. But Bruce is not just an artist. He's a Chicago spokesperson and a world-class troublemaker. He came to the neighborhood 50-plus years ago, and he's still sitting at the bar, a bar that provides the perfect backdrop to talk about the past, present, and future of Old Town. All right, Bruce, I can't think of a better person to talk to about Old Town. When did you move to this neighborhood?
I think you mean older person.
When did you move it to this area?
I moved to Old Town when I was 21 years old in 1961 and had my first legal drink in this bar. At the time, this bar was across the street from here.
1961, when you think of, I think of Old Town, I think of the 60s. I think this was sort of an epicenter for counterculture. And that's why I think a lot of people still think of Old Town, although it might be a little different today.
It's quite different. Well, for a kid, I mean, I was just a kid. But coming into the neighborhood, it had everything. I mean, you're right by the lake, you're right by the parks, you could walk downtown, but my first girlfriend and I, we had an apartment right down the street from here, a little two bedroom for $55 a month. I remember the first time I ever paid $100 a month for rent. Well, I didn't really pay it, but I thought it was the end of the world. There was no parking meters, and there was only like three or four bars in the neighborhood too at the time, and you could live for nothing. A stein of light beer at the Old Town Ale House was 25 cents.
I think of all the institutions. I mean, Second City still stands over Piper's Alley. This still stands.
Well, Second City at the time was at Wisconsin. It moved down a few years after I moved here.
But the institutions in this area, you could still see remnants of what it was in the 60s.
Oh, well, sure. I mean, Second City was huge then. So it's just a lot bigger now. Yeah, the neighborhood was filled with everybody. You had the old gangs. You had a Lebanese gang, the Solomon brothers, who ended up over at the Lincoln Hotel running a juice operation. Roland Farina, Dennis Farina's big brother, was like the toughest guy in the neighborhood. And plus, you had, before they widened North Avenue, you had all these old German bars three or four right across the street. And they were just, I mean, they were great. Patty Baller, the legendary 43rd yeah, right. Ward Alderman, his bar was right on the corner here. Over on
You said a couple times now that, it, you know, as we sit right here on North Avenue, you see now it's two lanes both ways. That was really the turning point for this neighborhood when they
when
widened.
When they widened, it was really the end of what we know as Old Town. It was that was like a wall. There was all kinds of racial things happening. I remember in the early 60s, at the time it was called Old Town Gardens, it now is Marshall Field Apartments. It's a two or three block housing complex over there. The first black person that moved in was Billy Williams when he was on the Cubs. And then the demographics just changed rapidly. And then Wells Street became commercialized, and you had all kinds of crazy stuff going on over there, one gimmick thing after another. And the movie theater, before they widened North Avenue, they turned it into a strip theater. I mean, strip TC. So, yeah, it kind of really went through some wild...
It's a neighborhood, I think, that politically... I've read about it. I mean, this used to be the epicenter of the counterculture movement, the yippies and the hippies.
Yeah, in fact, really, it was. It was Greenwich Village in New York, Old Town in Chicago, North Beach in San Francisco. There was just kind of this revolving people. Because you'd go to San Francisco, you'd bump into a whole bunch of people here. I go to the Lower East Side of the Village in New York, I'd bump in. You'd just bump
into
people.
So what happened? Why is it? I don't think of Old Town that
way
anymore.
Money. Once we're doing great, but... We don't have our regulars because they either died, their livers gave out, or they can't afford to live down here anymore.
Yeah, right.
So it's I don't see nearly as many regulars.
When it comes to politics, I mean, this was sort of, you really got a vibe that this was a neighborhood that was trying to affect change. Today, it seems to be more of, went for Rahm Emanuel, a city block that is probably more about the families and the condo buildings that are up and down these side streets than it is about anything we're talking about in history.
Oh, yeah. I don't think the people that build these million-dollar houses on the street come in here. I don't think that we're their Democrats.
What if you were going to talk to somebody out of town, run into somebody from Lower East Side and say, and they're like, what's Old Town like today? Well, how would you explain it?
It's probably not a whole lot different than Lincoln Park. It's expensive. It's really expensive. And this bar is just one of the last vestiges of what it used to be like. I mean, you walk into one of these bars on Wall Street, there's 25 large screen TVs. I mean, there's a bunch of kids. Now and here, you walk in and the average age at the bar on a normal night is probably 40, 50 years old.
In here?
Yeah.
Really?
But that's not typical for what's going on here.
And I've always liked this area, and my time at Second City, the Old Town Ale House was a spot. Why is this place still up and running when you look up and down?
Pure accident. It's so many people had to screw up in one way or another, and when the building went condo, everybody laughed at the previous owners, Art and B. Klug. They thought, oh, God, you don't know. There's no such thing as a condo bar. Well, if we were now paying $15,000 a month rent, this would not be here.
Yeah, this wouldn't be, right.
So just by pure ineptitude or luck, it's still here.
This area as well, when you talk about crime, I'll see once in a while on the news, you'll see some shootings. And it's in the air over by the Sedgwick
Well, we had a shooting in front of the bar.
What is it about Old Town? Do you consider this to be a safe neighborhood?
I think it's every bit as safe as Streeterville or Lincoln Park. I mean, there's no purely safe neighborhoods anymore. Sedgwick Street has a crime. You know, they tore down tearing down Cabrini Green was huge. But what happened then, a lot of the gang kids and families moved into what are called Marshfield Apartments. And so Sedgwick Street is probably, you know, there's drugs and crime. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how long that's going to last because people have spent a lot of money developing that neighborhood. So you have to wonder. I'm sure the boys at City Hall have got it all figured out already.
Well, you mentioned Cabrini Green. Read the history of in the the 60s and 70s in Chicago and Old Town. Cabrini Green was a big part of it. Do you sense that's a bygone era? Obviously, it's shut down.
Oh,
but
no, it's a bygone. And I think one thing, Richie Daley accomplished very little other than making the parking meters a nightmare in this town. But one thing he did accomplish, he planted more trees than the park district could destroy a year. And he did tear down most of these. His father. His father was all into those
all about the big high-rise
horizontal slums.
Yeah.
And he did most of that. That is gone. And it was really a horrible place. I mean, it was terrible for the people. I mean, I knew kids that grew up there that were afraid to go out. So now, of course, that's, you know, been totally yuppified over there.
That seems to be the thread with this neighborhood, is yuppified.
Yeah.
To think, you know, I saw today that Paul Krasner died.
And I'll tell you something about Krasner.
Yeah.
During the 68 Democratic Convention, I was living at the time in Berkeley, but I came in just for that. And I remember, I think it was Monday, and at the big Sunday, they had the big Sunday riot out there, a police riot. Monday, I was out there with a friend of mine named Lazar. We were poked around. He was taking pictures and stuff. So we decided to come over here about 5 for a beer and walked in the door. He had a camera. I still never forgive him for not taking this picture. Sitting at the bar was Jean Genet, Norman Mailer, Jose Torres, the boxing, former light heavyweight boxing, Allen Ginsberg, Paul Krasner, Gregory Corso, and Abby Hoffman was there. That was the old town day. That's a picture that, boy,
You would love to have that.
You know, Krasner was really the brains behind Hoffman and Jerry Rubin. I mean, he let them be the frontman, but he was really that, and the realist was really a great.
You know, to think about it, and everyone always focuses on the 68 convention, and obviously, you know, that being a monumental part of history, but it was the next year, which we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Days of Rage, where Old Town was a big part of that.
When they broke off from SD, when it got a little bit more real. Except it really wasn't real. It was a bunch of parlor pinkies took over SDS, because we had the only, over on Larrabee, the only, I think, non-college affiliated SDS chapter in the country. And I only found out years later we were a Progressive Labor Front group. I always wondered how we could have, where the money came to pay the rent and stuff. But, I bumped into somebody in Berkeley. I said, I never understood how we could sponsor the baseball teams and all that stuff. He said, are you kidding? We were a Progressive Labor Front group. They would pay for it. We're getting money from China. But I remember National Headquarters was over on 63rd Street, right by Stoney. The leaders that became the Weathermen, Ayers and Dorn and all those people, we called them parlor pinkies. They were all from rich families, and they were all just kind of, and so then they played radical and revolutionary. Right. I don't think they ever did any time either.
I think about it as a time here we sit in this bar, and this bar has such great vibes and great memories, but I think about Chicago. Can there be a progressive neighborhood? You know, when you think about what Old Town was in the late 60s.
Hyde Park was, and probably in a way still is. I think I live there now, and there's still that because of the university. I mean, it's also produced Milton Friedman and, who kind of advised the Juntas and all. But Hyde Park, I still would say, would be the closest thing. No, I wouldn't say so.
To think about all the people who have come through this bar, to think about all of the history that Chicago centers around the Old Town Ale House and Old Town, the neighborhood, is it just a history lesson at this point? People coming through here, could you do a walking tour and be able to point to the different things, or is it now just
black
screen bars and the Old Town Ale House?
There still are walking tours. There's still plenty to see here. It's still quite interesting, and especially when you get on the north side of North Avenue, they still have the old Town Triangle, and the original Old Town Art Fair is kind of cool. I mean, there's a lot.
Where do you see, when you've been sitting at this bar for as long as you have, where do you see this neighborhood going next? Just going to be a bigger, more expensive Lincoln Park, or will it retain some of its charm?
I think it'll retain some of its charm. I think they've made the Triangle area historical, so they're not going to be able to tear it down. So there will be that, and its proximity to the park, and hopefully this bar will prevail, you know, because it certainly kind of holds a lot of the old element together.
This bar, you know, I think it holds a special place in a lot of Chicagoans' heart. I mean, this is one of the bars that everybody at any point in their life living in Chicago has come through. You got to feel pretty good about that.
Oh, we do. And it's a fun thing. I mean, after Anthony Bourdain did a couple shows here, we get people from all over the world. I mean, it used to be on holidays, like the 4th of July weekend, everybody would be leaving town, our customers. But now we get people that from all over the place. I mean, I had two Egyptian doctors. The first place they came after they got to Chicago was the Old Town Ale House because they were fans of Anthony Bourdain.
I love it.
So, yeah, I think that the really meet interesting people. I mean, it's filled. I had two great Irishmen the other night. The first place they came was here. They were hilarious, just absolutely hilarious.
Bruce, thanks for talking to us about the Old Town Ale House and the neighborhood. And great to see you.
Nice to see you.
Yeah. Bruce Elliott,
not the first great conversation with Bruce, and hopefully not the last. Into the Old Town Ale House. It continues to thrive right there on North Avenue across from Second City. And we continue our Chicago neighborhood tours. If you want to catch up on the neighborhoods we've already been to, WGNRadio.com. Coming up, we're going to talk with Philip Potempa about the history of dinner theater and also with Teatro Zanzani. Talk about that show that's downtown now, but how Chicago has had a laid claim. They've had a long history with dinner theater, dating back to the Candlelight. Talk about memories of the Candlelight Theater, Drury Lane, and other dinner theaters here in Chicago. As well as, so that's kind of the same concept we're doing with the Old Town, talking about what it used to be and what it is now. And we're doing the same with Maxwell Street. We have that conversation come up a little bit later about what Maxwell Street Market is today as opposed to what it was back in the day. And if you are out and about this weekend, you're not going to Lollapalooza, you want something more authentic, the Maxwell Street Market's for you. Sunday, they're having a big festival with music and food, all sorts of activities, including Loreen and the Maxwell Street Market Blues Band, who are in our performance studio tonight. We're also going to be talking with them a little bit later in the show, but let's go back over there and get some more blues music here on Extension 720.
You know, when I think of Maxwell Street, I think of what a torch it is and how it passes from generation to generation, flows from person to person. And when I think of that, I think of guys like Earl Hooker and Robert Nighthawk, and we'd like to do something in that vein that goes something like this, an E. My baby man ain't that bad. I had a sweet little home, people. I lost my baby man, ain't that sad. Spend what you ain't got. You can lose what you ain't never had. I said I have money in the bank. I lost all my bread, man, ain't that bad. In the bank, I lost all my money, baby. Ain't that sad? So you can't spend what you ain't got, you can't lose what you ain't never had. Come on, Lord Lewis. Thank you.
old town, ain't that sad? Got ripped right down, down, right down to the ground, boys, ain't that bad? So you can't spend what you ain't got. You can't lose what you ain't never had. Take it with you, man.
Loreen and the Maxwell Street Market Blues Band. Lyrics there, Kevin Shanahan, and also on bass, Stuart Muhammad. We'll have more from that. I could listen to that all night long. Just stay on that. You know, I'm gonna have to settle for Sunday morning, as this group will be playing live at Maxwell Street as part of the festival they're putting together at Maxwell Street. We'll talk more about that coming up in the next hour, as well as the history of Chicago's dinner theater scene, one that is unparalleled and has historical roots, not just for the city, but possibly for the country. We'll talk about that as we talk about Teatro Zinzani, the new show that is bringing dinner theater back to Chicago. All that coming up here on Extension 720. Thanks, David. Extension 720 here on 720 WGN with you till 10 o'clock tonight. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Talk a lot of Chicago history, then and now stuff tonight. We talked about the Old Town Ale House and the Old Town neighborhood. We're also going to continue to talk about Maxwell Street and hear some more music from the Lab Band and have a conversation about what Maxwell Street, what the city's trying to do to bring Maxwell Street back. That's all coming up on Extension 720. Well, you may have heard about the new dinner theater craze right here in downtown Chicago. Teatro Zinzani is a show that's played all over the country and has found a home for a run at the Cambria Hotel. It's being billed as love, chaos, and dinner. Fast-paced action, acrobats, and aerialists alongside a multi-course feast. But what you may not know is that dinner theater has its roots right here in Chicago. The Candlelight Playhouse was opened in the late 50s by Bill Polinsky. Polinsky is credited with having the first theater that actually served meals in the theater. Before that, they were separate buildings. But that's just the start. Chicago's been home to many dinner theater legends, and Chicago entertainment and food columnist Phil Potempa is here to talk more about it. You can find Phil's work at the Post Tribune and ChicagoTribune.com. Phil, thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So let's start with Teatro Zinzani, because it really has been this blur of anticipation mm-hmm. and excitement, mm-hmm. because this is something that you don't usually see in theater.
Right, you know, and Chicago's long had a home to the Cirque shows that would come in Cirque du Soleil, but this really, it changes the whole dynamic because it's a standing show, so it should be here for a while. I mean, we're right downtown, the heart of it. You mentioned the Cambria Hotel, it's right next to what was the Oriental Theater, now we call it the James Niederlander Theater. And so Randolph Entertainment, as you mentioned, has been doing this at other cities around the country. They've teamed up with Broadway in Chicago, and this really just launched just a matter of a couple weeks ago. And it's really an immersive theater, which is what dinner theater is, because you're, as you said, you're dining and you're having the show unfold right in front of you. And what they've done is they've discovered up on one of the upper floors of this hotel an unused space that was not tapped into. It was a large great hall that was a Masonic space that just had not ever been developed. And what a great space it makes to do a dinner theater experience with sort of a virtual tent, but very elegant chandeliers. And so they completely have transformed it. And guests, maybe around 200 or so, will be in this kind of a circular dining experience. So it's sort of a theater in the round. Your tables are right there, kind of a cafe seating. And you get a sumptuous four-course meal. And what makes it different is this is really a top-notch cuisine. So it's not just going to kind of be, oh, your soup, your salad kind of a affair. But meanwhile, you're being entertained by acrobats, by clowns, some fantastic voices, be it operatic, in sort of a cabaret atmosphere, and still within around a $100 price range or so. So you can kind of go more up, a little upper scale. You can keep drinking and adding cocktails to it. And of course, your costs might go up a bit more. But it's something that's different. And so anybody that's visiting Chicago will want to make this on their list.
Bill, is this the kind of, I always wonder, like, what is their strength? Are they putting the emphasis on the performance, or are they putting the emphasis on the food?
Well, it's still kind of a work in progress for our venture here in Chicago. I mean, the dining was fantastic. The meal portions were substantial. I mean, I'm from a farm, so I'm a good-sized eater. I could still have probably eaten a little bit more off some of my dining neighbor's plates. But it's a four-course meal, so you're going to start off with an appetizer, then a salad, and then something either like maybe the salmon could be a main course, or it can be a beef short rib. Entertainment-wise, it's a little bit of a hodgepodge kind of mix-up. Well, you mentioned the name of this particular show they're doing is Love, Chaos, and Dinner. So it's supposed to kind of be, you don't know what's happening. It's immersive. But let me say, if you're somebody who's not really the person that wants to be called on stage or part of it, they are very respectful of that, so which is more of myself. So I was glad I was in one of the ladder rings along the walkway, because I didn't want to be a part of the tomfoolery. And all the servers are a part of it, too. So they're also not only slinging the hash and serving, but you'll see them up singing and supporting, you know, the key headliners as well.
I've teased this out, and we're going to talk more about the history of it, but the dinner theater in Chicago is alive and well. It's not just Teatro Sanzani. There are other places that are doing, you know, Pete mentioned, even when you think about City Winery and other places like that are doing shows. It may not be theater, but it might be music, but you can eat while you watch. Right. It seems like this, it harkens back to a past life, but at the same time is very, very current.
When I thought about this when I was driving in, I'm thinking there's other places as well that still do it. Your neighbor down the street, Tommy Gunn's Garage, they've been going forever, where you feel like you're at the speakeasy and you kind of knock on the door, and again, you're kind of in the middle of the action. That's going to be a little bit more of an everyday food fair, where again, this is it's very, very upscale. Mm-hmm. They mentioned that the recipe is being done by Debbie Sharp of The Goddess. That's a whole brand on its own.
She's great.
She's created this menu. And if somebody attends this one and says, I don't know if I kind of was into the whole acrobat or the clowns or, you know, the people spitting ping pongs in the air that's so close to where my table's at, maybe is not my thing, they're going to revamp and do an entirely new show in October that's going to be a little bit more suspense, and I'm guessing kind of a bit of a Halloween theme. So they're always going to kind of be rehashing and kind of reinventing it as we go along.
As you think about, it's hard not to think about Drury Lane. It's hard not to think about, like we said, some of the other places that were more themed. Tony and Tina's Wedding falls into that idea. Mm-hmm. But there are still a lot of active places that are serving dinner and showing theater.
And we got to give a nod where, we're going to talk a little bit about Bill Plinsey here in a minute, but we're going to give a nod to Drury Lane, which still exists in Oakbrook Terrace. And I grew up a little bit more with, I'd say, the South Side, Drury Lane, Martinique and Evergreen Park. And of course, that left us about 2002 or so. It closed. But that concept was true dinner theater, but a separate dining room. So you weren't actually dining, as you said, and past the breadbasket as they're, they're trying to tell you a story on stage. But Drury Lane has reinvented itself out in Oakbrook Terrace as well. Right now, they just opened with an Agatha Christie murder mystery, and then There Were None. It goes until September the 1st. And Tony DeSantis, who trailed a little bit behind Bill Plinsey. At one time he had four of these Drury Lanes. He had the Water Tower Drury Lane, the Evergreen Park one, and then the one in Oakbrook Terrace. And then way up north, our friends up in Lincolnshire, the Marriott, that was truly a part of the Drury Lane franchise at one time as well. And he passed in around 2007, around age 93. But his grandson has continued it, Kyle DeSantis, and completely redone it. So gone are all the mirrors and the heavy red velvet drapes.
You're kind of missing that.
It's much more swank out in Oakbrook Terrace. And the same thing with the dining option. It's a preset course in the dining room, but they've named it Lucille after Kyle's grandmother. And it's much more upper scale. some people might miss, again, the set menu where, again, you had the soup, the salad, you got, you know, a good portion of mashed potatoes. This is a little bit more kind of an a la carte opportunity.
Phil Potempa is here. He is the entertainment and food columnist for both the Post Tribune, ChicagoTribune.com. We're talking about the dinner theater and, of course, with Teatro Zinzani, which has just made its debut here in Chicago downtown. When we come back, let's talk more about who you brought to Teatro Zinzani and a little bit about the history of dinner theater here in Chicago. It's Extension 720 on WGN. Stay with us. Talking dinner theater here on Extension 720 with Philip Potempa. He's the entertainment and food columnist for the Post Tribune and ChicagoTribune.com. 312-981-7200. If you are one of the lucky ones that remember places like the Candlelight or the Martinique and other places that Phil was just talking about, give us a ring, let us know, or you can text, of course, your memories, 312-981-7200. And there's going to be a lot because Chicago played a big role when it came to dinner theater. When you look even as basic things like Wikipedia, they talk about Chicago as the front and center chapter because the names that we're talking about here in these theaters were national. They were the first of their kind.
Exactly. So Chicago really does have a history front row seat for dinner theater. And we were talking about this when we were chatting about, okay, this new theater experience is happening, Teatro Zinzani. Who better than Bill Plinzy to check it out and see what he thinks? The man recognized as the godfather for the dinner theater concept, and this is true. Bill, along with a foothold here in Chicago now, he lives in Dyer, Indiana. He's just right across the state line, but he's the one that started the Candlelight Dinner Playhouse, which is right over in Summit, Southside Chicago by Midway Airport off Harlem Avenue. And that happened 60 years ago, wow, back in 1959. He and his college buddy, Tony D'Angelo, thinking about, what about this idea if we give a good-priced meal and pair it with a great show? What a ticket opportunity. And they're tossing this around. Come to Chicago, 1961, launch the Candlelight. And I love what Bill says, that for $6, you got a three-course meal. You got your soup, your main course, your cocktail, your dessert, and the show ticket, all for $6. Of course, we don't have those kind of prices now, but you know, that was true dinner theater in the sense that you were going to see something like My Fair Lady. You were going to see, mm-hmm, Man of La Mancha. It wasn't acrobats hanging overhead, which, you know, I think Bill maybe raises his eyebrows a little bit. But, you know, he stays contemporary and realizes that, again, that's the art of theater. It needs to reinvent itself. It needs to be current, and that's what they're doing right now.
Now, Bill couldn't be here tonight, but, you know, when we talk about him seeing that experience, mm-hmm, what was the conversation like afterwards? Is he like, this is of course the evolution I was talking about? This is, or was he like, they're not doing it right? Where's the bread? Where's the salad?
Well, again, I think he's up for anything that's going to keep the experience alive. And he was this close to being with us in the studio, but he's a hard person to peg down. He, of course, has a connection in that Tony D'Angelo and his wife Eileen Licaro, they were right there side by side with him at the Candlelight Playhouse, and Eileen is a part of Broadway in Chicago. So she thought it was a great idea. Let's get Bill in here, our old friend, and see what he thinks. And Bill's honest. He'll you know, say right to the front if there's some things he thinks needs to be tweaking or some things that need to be changed. You know, again, I think he's less of the plate spinning in the air a la Bozo show and more of a classic music man or phantom type of a person. But again, he could appreciate that a young taste change, and they want to be a part of what is the now.
Were they aware? Was Teatro Zinzani, yes, aware of the royalty, the legend that was in the building?
Eileen is certainly, and she and I were in cahoots to have make sure that Bill had a ticket. So definitely, yeah, it was a part of the experience. And you know, one of the things, this idea of having headliners, which Teatro Zinzani does, that was what the Martinique would do. They would bring in all of these folks that you would see on TV, and they would have a celebrity headliner be a part of that experience. So that's certainly not a new concept, having somebody that has a name or that's noted and connected to help with that marquee value of the whole experience.
Right. And it seems that that's the texts that are coming in. 262 says, my folks used to take me to the Fireside in, yes, Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin, for dinner theater, places doing dinner shows. That's Dave. 815, and I'm not sure if it's dinner theater or not, but I remember my mom and dad taking me to see to the Sabre Room. for my 21st birthday to see Count Basie and his orchestra. So
yeah, music, entertainment, yeah. And the dinner. Across the state line, I got to mention in Indiana that if you go as far as Indianapolis, Beef and Boards has been around for decades. And that is true, Justin, where before you're sitting in a kind of a tiered kind of a landscape of tables, you go down on the stage where they roll out the buffet. And so you're scooping out your mastacholi. We're just in about, you know, an hour and 20 minutes later, there's going to be the leading lady in the spotlight. And they roll off the buffet and the lights go down. And you have the little lamps on the table. So that's still around. And then in Munster, Indiana, which is near and dear to my own heart, right now they're doing Over the Tavern this Thursday night. They have a dinner theater night. So not every performance is dinner theater, but it still lives on. We have that opportunity to kind of package it with a meal.
It's interesting because, you know, I kind of chuckle when I hear about, you know, you rolling out the buffet on the stage and the mastacholi and the whole bit. But there is something to be said about it. At a certain point, I don't know if it was a pop culture thing or if it was just a generational thing, but dinner theater almost became punchline.
Yes.
You saw from late night talk shows or whatever it might be, just this idea that, you know, it's corny. Right. And this is theater and corny, and you think of you know, people eating their prime rib and you know, a lot of clinking glasses while people are on stage. So there has been it did go through a little bit of a time where it became the butt of the joke.
Well, and you ask, why isn't the Candlelight still here? You know, Summit, Illinois is right there, and Harlem Avenue is there. And that's just it ran its course in that, you know, what they had programmed there had ran so long because it was a hit, they kind of slowly lost some of their subscribers. And then a Krispy Kreme went in that same spot and a Portillo's, which I love Portillo's, but it's too bad that the Candlelight is not there. But if you think about it, dinner theater is still happening in Las Vegas, Branson. Mm-hmm. They do the same concept. That's what Teatro Zanzani's doing. And I'm sure it's going to get a lot of folks that will come and experience. And as long as they're changing it and including the programming, you know, it'll I think have some lifeblood.
Yeah, it's fascinating too because, you know, it makes a lot of sense to have dinner because there's so many restaurants now that'll pop up. If you just think about Broadway in Chicago, all the restaurants that kind of pop up around it to try and grab the theater crowd before they go in and out. So it does make a lot of sense. Why don't we see more of it? Why has this become a kitsch or just one genre of theater? Why haven't we seen theaters embrace this concept fully?
It is a tricky, that's why my hat's off to Bill Polinsky for running his space as long as he did. It's a tricky balancing act, no pun intended. Think about it, you have to have meals served and the meals have to be hot, and you have to also then have the entertainment and anybody that's been behind the scenes, and it's like a radio show with theater, things are timed to the nth degree to make sure you have everything that moves in and out like it has to, and to have people eating. Some people also just don't like the performers knowing that there's that distraction.
Right.
We kid about, you know, someone of your, I think your producer said earlier about somebody's trying to ask me what my soup choice is, and I'm trying to pay attention to what's going on stage. It's a costly investment if it's not going to work. And trust me, the folks at Randolph Entertainment and Broadway in Chicago have backed this considerably. And you're right, there's a lot of promotion. You knew all about it. Mm-hmm. We talked about this weeks before. You know, that's what it takes to get the word out. And then most of all, that word of mouth. If it's good, it'll continue to be the ripple effect. If it's not good, it'll also be the ripple effect, but not in the way you want.
Right. Lydia, who's out in Niles, says, what about the Mill Run Theater and the Millionaires Club at Golf Mill? So obviously there seems to be, if not a current love of the dinner theater, but at least fond memories of what dinner theater meant to Chicagoans.
Yeah, and again, I think that pricing is so important. It's got to be fairly priced because if you outprice it, then it only becomes something that, you know, the elite can do. And that's not what dinner theater was ever about. It was just the opposite. It was a bargain, something that you were going to go away feeling as though you definitely had gotten the most bang for your buck.
You know, that's a great point that, you would think that dinner theater might be more elite because, you know, obviously you're pairing sort of fine dining with theater. Mm-hmm. But you're absolutely right. This was more of to approach and to retain or to attract a more working class audience who may think of the theater as being something that is unattainable to them.
Right. And again, I grew up with the food at the Drury Lane Oak Brook and the Drury Lane in Martinique, and I thought it was phenomenal. Again, I'm plucked from a cornfield, but I thought it was a great price for what you would receive. And I thought there was ambiance. I liked the mirrors, and I liked the heavy red drapes and the tassels and all of that experience. But this again, it is kind of a bit of a throwback. When you walk in, first thing there, they've got trays of champagne at Teatro Zanzini, and they have a big gift shop with different kinds of Mardi Gras masks and purses and things. To, again, a lot of props. It's it's really a little, I think, an assault of the senses, and that's the thing. If Bill Polinsky was maybe flinching a little bit as he was watching, I'm sure it would be a thing of such as a little overwhelming of the senses, because there's so much going on around you. But that's what you want. You want to feel like for that hour and a half, you're in another world of imagination. Yeah.
Philip Potempa, the entertainment and food columnist for the Post Tribune, Chicago Tribune, talking about the history of dinner theater and the show Teatro Zanzani, which is on stage now at the Cambria Hotel, right on Randolph, right next to the Niederlander Theater. Philip, great to have you on the show. Looking forward to having you on more. So thank you very much for being on Extension 720.
Thank you.
Back to Justin Kaufman and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
There you go. You got your fear of dinner theater taken care of. Pete, Phil Potempa. Nice to have him on. He was on with Patty as a regular for a couple years. Yeah, I don't remember too much dinner theater in my life. I feel like my uncle Guy Burrill was a big actor in Chicago. And there were a couple times he did dinner theater. He did shows at the Drury Lane that we would go down to. I want to say it was the Martinique. This would have been the 80s. It could have been Oak Brook. I don't know. It's just I knew there was an expressway. We had to get to expressway.
A couple of years ago, I went to one of the theaters up on near me on Glenwood, in Rogers Park. They were doing a production of Rent. And Chris Jones raved about it. It was a tremendous show. And Rent, perhaps you've heard of it. it was one of those things where it's like you buy the ticket and then for $10 extra you can have dinner there before the show starts. So we're having dinner, and dinner was great and all. We're eating, and then everybody was nice, and then the show starts, and we realized that the servers were the actors.
Oh, the hell yeah.
Like the people that were serving you the food were actually on the screen, and I was like, oh, man.
And now you have to wonder, do I have to tip them?
Again? Now, I wonder, maybe you were confused because you're like, hey, you look like a grunge guitar player who lives in an apartment struggling to pay his rent. Oh, you're in the show. Oh, got it. Yeah, I don't remember. But to be honest, I'm surprised there's not more of it.
Yeah.
So it doesn't, and obviously just talking about the Candlelight and the Martinique. What a great name for a theater, the Martinique. The Martinique showed up on our That Used to Be game show that we did with Scott Goldstein, which I do want to bring back once we have a little bit more time when the White Sox season's over, where we would give you an address. And then you would have to guess, and if you guessed, you got a pizza, whatever it was we're giving away. And the Martinique showed up, I think, wherever that was. Was it 95th and Western?
Yeah.
It was right that spot, yeah. Not too far from the Foot Locker, in which you worked at.
I did some time at the Evergreen Park Foot Locker, too. It was the biggest Foot Locker in the United States.
See?
They did the most money ever. Seriously. No, I shouldn't say the second. The one in Honolulu did they did more volume.
Oh, I see. That's amazing. That's an amazing stat. She gets you could be our Foot Locker historian here on Extension 720. If you'd like to know more about the sales at the Foot Locker at the mall, feature guy. How much was a Georgetown Hoyas hoodie going for? Like the parka hoodies? I love those.
The starter brand?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
$200 at least, right? Yeah. That's where you had to get the hook and bring it down because it's all the way up to prevent theft.
Who was the last great Georgetown player?
Allen Iverson, but there was a kid.
Patrick.
Was Ewing? It Ewing Jr.? Wasn't there a junior that played there?
No. It was, I can't remember his name, but he was a center. I think he played for the Knicks for a while.
Yeah. Patrick Ewing.
It was Patrick Ewing?
Yeah.
Okay.
You're really dating yourself there. That was a young kid. He played there in the 80s, 70s.
Been retired for 40 years.
Yeah.
What can I tell you?
Jennings with the sports report.
I remember when the St. John's Redmen were a hot team.
Yeah, and you are dating yourself.
I know.
A long time.
Inappropriate.
All right. There we go.
Go ahead. Laugh at it. Pick on me.
Welcome back to Extension 720 and 720 WGN. Well, the place to be this weekend will be the Maxwell Street Market. Of course, many people think that the Maxwell Street Market may have gone away, but it has had a resurgence right there in the South Loop, right just north of where the original Maxwell Street is at. Alyssa Baum is in studio, and she is with DCASE, Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events.
Great to have you here. Let's talk about Maxwell Street. Why the emphasis on Maxwell Street this weekend?
We're very excited about Maxwell Street. We've been working very hard for the past year to rebuild it. We have a great vision of what it will become eventually. And this celebration is just to let the city know that the Department of Cultural Affairs is dedicated to Maxwell Street. We want to bring it back to its full glory, and we're working very hard to bring culture and the entrepreneurship and the entrepreneurial spirit that it's always had to light and bring more attention.
It's such an interesting part of Chicago history because everyone knows Maxwell Street, but they also know about the demise of Maxwell Street and the college coming in there and the end of an era. We went through that in the 90s where it was like that was a couple of years long project of wishing well of Maxwell Street. So do you have to not only, you know, have success in bringing it back, but you have to almost reteach people that it's back, because a lot of people think that, you know, the obit's been written and the Maxwell Street experience is gone.
That's true. A lot of people think that. A lot of people don't realize it's still going on. And we are out there every Sunday from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. And there are vendors who have been there for 30 years. There are people who have inherited the business from their parents. Even in our office, we have a woman who grew up vending at Maxwell Street. And everywhere we go, like, we've put together an advocacy committee. We have people from all over Chicago who are helping us to rebuild. And we run into so many people who are like, oh yeah, that I was out there. That's what I was doing when I was trying to put myself through college or whatever. Everybody has a story about Maxwell Street.
Oh, absolutely.
Market. It's super fun.
It's important to my family. My dad would talk about being on the vegetable and fruit trucks on Maxwell Street. I mean, it is a part of the DNA of this city. When you want to rebuild it, and it has been there for years now, and it's been more of an open-air market than it is sort of like an open-air festival, if you will, with the blues and other stuff, how do you go about doing that? How do you bring the old to the new?
Well, we have been making a lot of changes over the past year that are probably not obvious to a lot of people, but to make it more attractive to vendors to bring people in. And there are a lot of options for being a vendor there. We have the tried and true people, but people can come in, they can vend once a month, they can come every week. There used to be rules that if you weren't out there every week, you couldn't come back, you're out. And so we're trying to make it more vendor friendly. We're also doing a lot of things like, you know, we have this festival coming up, but we have music out there every few weeks. This year we are partnering with the National Museum of Mexican Art, and they are out there every other week with art making activities for kids. So they have a different focus. You can look on our website and check out what it is. Like, we started this season with History of the Blues, and they had some coloring of old blues musicians for kids and doing different activities. So we just have a lot of fun out there.
Your background is in music. You've been a part of the Chicago music scene for years. How important is music, live music, to the Maxwell Street experience?
I think it's hugely important. I mean, as we know, a lot of the electric blues musicians from Chicago started out at Maxwell Street just as buskers. They would just go out there, play, have fun, meet each other. And, you know, one of our bands has the same exact story that was happening back in the 50s, where they're out at Maxwell Street playing and now they're a band. And, you know, we try to have them out there as much as we can. We had a couple weeks ago, we had Circus Steam Social Circus out there. We try to have different kinds of activities.
Yeah, right.
We reflect what D-Case is doing as a whole. So when it is Blues Fest in Millennium Park, we have Blues Fest out at Maxwell Street. We had the Dave Herrero Machine. They had a great performance. House Fest, we had the parking lot full of people dancing to house music. It was awesome. I was thinking, this is at noon on a Sunday. No one's going to be dancing. And, you know, we had a DJ out there and people came out dancing all over the place. It was amazing.
All right. So this festival, this takes place on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And what do we need to know about it? Where is it at? Because it's not actually on Maxwell Street. It's a little bit north on Jefferson.
On Desplaines.
Desplaines. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. So the festival takes place on Desplaines. It's 800 South Desplaines is our address, but it's on Desplaines between Harrison and Taylor Street. Yep. It's free. We will have tons of food. We have a special limited edition beer from Mars Brewery, which we're super excited about. You can't see this on the radio, but we have a specially designed label that by artist Jeff Zimmerman. Yeah. It's beautiful.
Been a guest on the show, yeah.
Yeah, so we're very excited about that. We're working really hard to put this together. And we'll have a ton of vendors. We'll have our tried and true vendors that we love, and we have renamed them. They're called legacy vendors now.
All right.
Because we want to honor them for their commitment to the market. And then we're going to have a lot of new vendors. We have Chicago Fair Trade coming out and bringing fair trade vendors that will be selling their wares, and a lot of other new vendors coming out. So it's going to be fun. So it's about four blocks of good times, things to buy, great, great food, beer, music. It's going to be a great time.
Alyssa Baum is with the Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events, and this weekend is the festival at Maxwell Street. It's 800 South Des Plaines in Chicago. Starts early. What's early?
9 a.m. to 3 p.m.
That's early on a Sunday. Alyssa, thanks for coming in tonight. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. As we continue to talk about Maxwell Street, it's hard to talk about Maxwell Street. We can just listen to Maxwell Street Blues, Loreen, and the Maxwell Street Market Blues Band. Been in studio all night in performance studio. They got one more in them. And then we're going to talk with the band afterwards about their humble beginnings at the market. But let's first listen to some music. The last track tonight, it's called Every Day I Have the Blues, and Stuart Muhammad, who was playing bass, and is now taking over vocals on this one. Here they are, Loreen and the Maxwell Street Market Blues Band.
Every day I get the blues. Every day I get the blues. See me worry, baby, you I hate to lose. Nobody love me, nobody seem to care. Nobody love me, nobody seem to care. Speaking of hard times and trouble, no, I had my share. Pack my suitcase, move on down the line. Pack my suitcase, move on down the line. Nobody worry, nobody crying.
Every day I have the blues.
Every day. you I hate to lose.
There you go, Loreen and the Maxwell Street Blues Band. That is on the vocals on that one was Stuart Muhammad, also Kevin Shanahan we heard earlier, and Loreen, who is Lori Lewis. The band, of course, is formed on Maxwell Street. They play at the Maxwell Street Market, and they're going to be playing this weekend as the Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events puts on a big festival. They're going to be playing Sunday morning. You find all that information out online. The band is with me in studio, and I want to start with you, Loreen. I know the name of the band is the Loreen and the Maxwell Street Blues Band, but is that accurate at how you guys got started?
It's named after the market because that's where we all met. And we started performing together as a band. There's a guy, Steve Balkin, who is retired now, but he's a professor at Roosevelt University. And his specialty, amongst others, is open-air markets. And his love is the Maxwell Street Market. And he called me up one day. This is when I very first started playing, and I wasn't even very good. He called me up and he said, "Lori, I need your help. There's not too much music. Will you host a jam down at the market?" And after I got done laughing, because I said, "Steve, I'm not very good. I can't do that." He said, no. He said, "But you're really good at organizing things. So will you come down and help me organize it?" I said, "That I can do." So he said, "I got a bunch of musicians that are coming down on Sunday, and you can just help get this thing going." I said, "Okay." So I go down there. Nobody shows up.
So I thought, life of a musician,
well, as
right?
long as I hauled all my stuff down here, I think I'll just sit and play and see what happens. So I played, and at the end of the day, Stuart comes wandering up, and he's like, introduced himself, and he said, "I play bass, and I play saxophone, I play other instruments." He said, "Are you going to be here next week? I'll bring my stuff." I said, "Okay, I'll come next week." So then Stuart and me started playing, and a few weeks later, we had another guitar player show up, and a little while later, we had a drummer show up, and by the end of the summer, we had a band.
You know, when you think of the Maxwell Street Market, and it's changed over time. I mean, obviously, the Maxwell Street, the original market, when it was at its heyday, that was the idea. You had blues musicians on corners, even on little soapboxes, you know, playing and adding to the element. The Maxwell Street Market, as we know it now, less of that. It's more about the vendors. But how important is it to have the blues and Chicago's music in the open-air market that is the Maxwell Street Market?
I think it's very important because Maxwell Street Market is really the home of Chicago's electrified blues. Maxwell Street Market is the place where all the blues musicians, when they first came to town, that's where they went. And they went and they set up and they would play there and they'd play for tips and they'd make their money and they'd make connections with other musicians and they would get gigs. And it's a very important part of Chicago's blues heritage. You know, the Maxwell Street Market has always been a market of immigrants, too. So if you think about how the blues fits, you know, in the around the turn of the early 19th century, it was, you know, a lot of Jewish and a lot of Eastern European immigrants. And so you had, like, a lot of klezmer music around
there.
Then, you know, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, you had a lot of African Americans migrating up and during the Great Migration from the South. So you had a lot of blues music. Now the market is primarily a lot of Hispanic folks. So, you know, it's always been the kind of immigrant market, you know, amongst others.
Let me ask the guys, Kevin, for you, how important is it to be a musician, a blues musician, to have the opportunity to play something as iconic as the Maxwell Street Market?
Oh, well, to me, it just means the world. I've been playing these music for over 20 years now, and to me, it's about, like, the music and the people, and it really is generational. It's like a torch that's carried on from generation to generation. It flows from person to person. It's all, I mean, it's so feeling, you can actually feel it. And it's just a real honor to be part of, like, to be part of keeping that alive.
Yeah.
And like when we come together and try to play this music for you, we're coming from a place, you know, from a place in our deep down in us that, you know, Maxwell Street Market was such a melting pot for all of the greatest from, you know, from down south and everywhere, really.
Stuart, I want to bring you in because you, as a musician on the stage, I mean, you perform, of course, at the new Maxwell Street Market, but you played at the old Maxwell Street Market. What's the difference to be playing the open-air market that it is today versus what it was before? Are they similar or are they just completely different experiences?
I'm going to tell you the actual truth. It's all the same. Blues never change. That's one thing about the blues. When you get the blues, you know, a lot of people don't realize they do have the blues when they can't pay their rent, when they can't pay their phone bill. That's the blues.
That's right.
And we just love to play the blues.
What was it like for you to be a young blues musician playing Maxwell Street?
Back in the day, it was every Sunday. We get up in the morning.
come down to Maxwell Street, set up, play for tips, and have a good time. That's where everybody came and danced and had a good time. And that's what we did every Sunday.
Do you miss that? I mean, obviously you get the opportunity, but you miss it?
Yeah. I really miss it.
What do you miss?
I miss the music. I miss the people. Open market. You can't go wrong when you come down blues heaven. That's what I call it, blues heaven.
Blues heaven.
Maxwell Street.
That's great. Obviously, the Maxwell Street market has changed over time, but a little bit of a resurgence now. When it comes to open-air markets, nothing beats Maxwell Street.
Oh.
You can go down this Sunday, and you can see they're doing a big festival down there for the city. You got to go see Loreen and the Maxwell Street Market Blues Band. When are you guys on?
We are on at 10:30 to 11:30, but there is activities going on the whole day. The schedule is jam-packed.
Thanks so much for coming in and performing, and we look forward to more.
Thank you so much for having us. We really appreciate it.
All right, that's going to do it for Extension 720 tonight. Coming up, Catherine Lake and Kelly Pope back in studio again. Catherine, good to see you.
I can't believe this. They keep putting us on the air, Justin. I don't understand it.
For good reason. Kelly, good to see you.
Guys, see you too.
So what do you guys got on the show today?
Tell them, Kelly.
We have, we're going to talk about the hacking.
Capital One.
Data breach.
Right.
What the heck is going on?
We're going to talk about some more embezzlement. We're
going
to talk about red collar crime when people get murdered over financial crime.
Look at
it.
It's like right out of an espionage movie, right?
Yeah, we have a lot to talk about.
Yeah, that's good. Well, obviously with the hack stuff, it feels like we're getting to a point where this is just going to be the new normal, right?
I just put everything out. I'm just going to post it.
Seriously.
I'm going to post all my numbers on Facebook.
Seriously. Somebody needs to call you and say, how do we avoid this?
The Capital One hack is a big deal, but the story I saw that was about identity theft today was that somebody was stealing Taraji B. Henson's
identity.
And the question I had, and I talked about this on the Laura Wacker Live podcast, was someone impersonating her, or was it just someone who got a credit card number? It's like, I just want to know, like, across the board, like, did the person know that they were stealing Taraji B. Henson's identity?
Whole thing.
Right? Yeah. Like, that, if there's any joy or pride in the fact that they're like, right, I've got the Social Security number of one of the hottest actors in Hollywood.
So glad you even can say that name, because I wouldn't have been able to come
Taraji
up with the name.
No, okay, she's great. Okay. She's great.
Right.
But yeah, I just wondered if that was
Empire.
Yeah.
You know,
our Hustle and Flow.
See, I should have watched Empire, because I have a friend I actually know personally who was on that show.
You got to do it. The beauty of television these days is you can go back and watch.
It's true. It's true. I can find it. I'm not behind the eight ball completely.
And you can also go back and watch Taraji B. Henson on Person of Interest.
Oh, that's right.
That's right.
Coincidentally.
My son, we were watching The Burbs, the Tom Hanks movie.
Right.
And there was a great scene where they're playing Jeopardy together, he and Carrie Fisher, and Art, the neighbor, is knocking on the window like, Ray, I need you, Ray.
Yeah, yeah.
And he gets up and he's mad and he walks out, and my 12-year-old son says, well, why didn't they just pause it?
It was
the mid-80s, and I'm like, there was no pausing back there. They miss it if they missed it.
Yeah,
all right, we'll have a great show, you guys.